Hello, young lovers, whoever you are, I hope your troubles are few. All my good wishes go with you tonight. I've been in love like you. You be brave, young lovers, and follow your star. Brave and faithful and true. And cling very close to each other tonight.
Welcome back. I'm Michael Ray. You're listening to Thought-Provoking Talk on Dresser After Dark.
Have wings on your heels and to fly down the street in a trance. You fly down that street on the chance that you'll meet, and you meet not by chance.
Orrin Checkmate Hudson with us. He is the author of One Move at a Time, How to Play and Win at Chess and Win at Life. Once he chased crooks, now former state trooper, Orrin Checkmate Hudson deals with rooks and pawns and knights and kings, teaching inner city kids how to think their lives instead of shooting them out. And let's say, Orrin, hi, welcome to the show.
Oh, it's a pleasure to be here. And the message is think it out, don't shoot it out, brains before bullets.
Well, I tell you what, that is probably the most brilliant way to touch anyone if you really think about it, because if you sit down with chess, you have to think, don't you?
Yeah, you have to think, and one move could cost you the game, so you want to think things through before you move and learn from every decision that you make.
Now, let me ask you this. When was it for you that light bulb came on that said, hey, if I want to communicate with these kids, this is the way to do it. This is that bridge to get to that point of understanding.
Well, the turning point in my life is when 30 years ago, a white teacher in an all-black high school taught me how to play chess. And I look back on my life, and it kind of like saved my life in terms of making better choices, better decisions, hanging with the right people. And so I think I'm just basically paying it forward, sharing with others what has helped me overcome some obstacles. I was raised in the housing projects. I had 12 brothers and 12 sisters. It was 13 of us all together. And so chess is an excellent tool to teach young people how to think their way through.
Now, by the way, when the kids start to learn to think, how does that start to change their life? Because I know that most things that people do, Orrin, it's just it's emotional. It's fast. It's quick. You react to something. You do it. But it's the teaching. Where do they start to get the feel that if they have to slow down and think this out, that it works in the other areas of their life?
Well, I think the main thing we're teaching young people is just patience. Patience is a secret weapon that will eventually reveal deception. And so you have to inspect what you expect and never assume. Like, for an example, I may say to a student, I have checkmate, and they go, well, I don't see it. And then after a while, they go, okay, I see it. It was there all along, but it took them a while to see it. And so we try to teach children patience. Patience is a virtue. If you learn to think things through and make good choices and realize that the law of gender says things take time to manifest. And so we're teaching impulse control, how to delay gratification, how to work while you wait, delay gratification, and make every move count.
Well, the question really here, then, that we bring this to the table, why aren't we teaching kids this in grammar school?
I think we should. I mean, I think it's definitely something that's needed. I think it will help people be better problem solvers. All I'm doing is basically teaching children how to solve problems, letting children know that you win or lose based on your ability to solve problems. And the bigger the problem you solve, the more you get paid.
Now, by the way, it is all about, Orrin, when we think about it, it's all about something called value. We have, 25-35% dropout rate for high school kids across the nation. Detroit, I think, was something like 50%. And some of the other cities, it's worse than that. And what it really boils down to is this, that the value for leaving is senior than the value for staying. And if nobody's going to take the time, and when I say hold their hand, symbolically hold somebody's hand and let them know that you care about them, they're not going to waste the time. They're going to go find someplace else where they're accepted, they have identity, and they're cared about. So I think this in and of itself is a great place to be. Wouldn't it be great if parents, even before they got to school, sat down and started to teach their kids chess? Look at the bonding process that most parents and kids don't have.
Yeah, it's a good little way to kind of teach children to kind of slow it down a little bit and realize that there is no such thing as failure. And so if you play me and you lose, that it's no big deal because there's no such thing as failure. It's only information. You get a chance to get information. So we teach children to make losing your vitamin.
Yeah, and by the way, losing is not losing. You know, there was a time when you got in and you played a sport and you did something, and losing just meant you got up, you got tougher, and you went back in and you played a little bit harder. Losing has a whole different definition today than it had 30, 40, 50 years ago. And I really believe if a couple of kids could sit down and they played chess, it's not who wins or loses because you both win of what you get out of it underneath. That message underneath is the ability to cause yourself to think, cause yourself to stand by and stand back and take a breath before you reacted or responded to someone. And I will bet any amount of money that in itself, Warren, saves lives.
Exactly. And so we want to teach young people how to be a problem solver, how to learn how to lose. I was watching the NBA finals, and or maybe not the finals, but close to the finals, and the L.A. Lakers was losing. And some of the players started, you know, doing some crazy things. And I'm like, wow, they got to learn how to lose, okay? You know, and so some players on the team did not know how to lose with dignity. So we got to teach children that, you know, everybody can't win. And that there are going to be some good days and some bad days. You just got to learn how to lose.
Yeah, and by the way, and in many cases, losing is winning. If you lose, it's going to teach you, if you look at it, if you look below the surface, it's going to teach you something. It's going to teach you that maybe you should have done this better the next time. Maybe you could do that better the next time. And whatever the case may be, losing in many cases is the best opportunity that somebody can have because it causes them to get better.
Exactly. So make it okay to fail. And, you know, every master was once a disaster. Everybody starts off at zero. And so you got to be wise enough to know, okay, stay in the game, never give up, and learn from every decision that you make.
Now, by the way, let's talk about a term here for a moment, because you've gotten many honors, you know, through the national self-esteem programs. What is self-esteem? When you really come down to it and you find the kids without it, when they get it, how do you recognize it? What is self-esteem? Where does it come from? And where does that kid get that spark when they realize that they can have it?
Well, self-esteem comes from doing something that you maybe didn't think you could do, or maybe an accomplishment. You know, running the wrong way in the end zone is not self-esteem because there's no opposition. I mean, people will let you go the wrong way in the end zone. The self-esteem comes from when you challenged by something in front of you and they're trying to stop you. Self-esteem is when you feel good about yourself. And we try to prove children self-esteem because they go, wow, if I can do this, what else I can do that I didn't initially think I could do? So we're just trying to build their self-confidence, self-esteem, so that they can, so that they'll be willing to try different things and go for it. And so we're just trying to let kids know that no one's better than you and that everybody has a chance. And so the ground, nature is neutral. See, the ground will return whatever you plant. It doesn't care what you plant, but it will return what you plant. So we just try to teach young people to make it okay to fail, learn from every decision that you make, and go for it.
Now, by the way, Oren, where is the program at now? If a parent wants to get their kid involved, where's the program?
Yeah, we're based right now in Stone Mountain, Georgia. We have a training center across the street from three schools, Pine Ridge Elementary, Stevenson High School and Stevenson Middle School. So we have a little training center that we empower young people and teach them heads up, pants up, grades up, and the big one, never give up.
And by the way, I think the never give up is very powerful. Schools today teach kids to give up. You know, then you know, I come from a world, and it's 100 years ago now, if it's a year, that, you know, if you played sports, somebody was better, somebody won, somebody lost. And, you know, you didn't come in, you know, 15th in the race and get an award for it. It doesn't work that way. It doesn't teach them that word called competition. And competition is so important because when they get out of school, there's going to be competition in the jobs, in the professions, and all across the board. So I think the kids today are getting cheated when they don't realize when they get an award for being, you know, the 110th runner that came in the race. It's got to be the first three or four are the best, and then you work your whatever it is off to be able to get yourself in a place to beat those two or three or four. And that, in and of itself, creates some self-esteem.
Exactly. So, you know, we want to let kids know that they are important, that they count, that they're needed, and that they were born for a purpose out of the mind of God, and they can do great things with their life if they stop and think.
It works for me. Okay, we're just about out of time. Is there a website that we can find you at, Orin?
Yeah, www.besomeone.org is my website, and email is orin@besomeone.org. My name has two R's in it. They call me Orin Checkmate Hudson. Besomeone.org is our website. My message for young people is heads up, pants up, grades up, and the big one, never give up.
I hear you big time. Hey, Orin, thank you so much. Good job. And good skill. Go get them.
Appreciate you.
Good night.
It isn't what Rome is, so why stay there when there are so many fabulous faraway places to see? Why should Spain and Tahiti and Rio just be only names to you and me? I feel certain there's people we'd be glad to know there. So tell me, why don't we get up and just go there? Go to those fabulous places where we long to be. Like Bangkok, Hong Kong, Paris and Venice, Tokyo and Cairo and Lisbon and London. Wonderful, fabulous places we're longing to see. There are so many simply incredible places to see. When I think of the warm Caribbean, I see a new world for you and me. I'd give anything just to have one single day there. And once we get there, I know that we'll stay there. Stay in those fabulous places where we long to be. Like Bangkok, Hong Kong, Paris and Venice, Tokyo and Cairo and Lisbon and London, Siam, Siena, Vienna, Verona, Java, Jamaica, Bombay, Barcelona. Show me those fabulous places we're longing to see.
Welcome back. I'm Michael Ray. You're listening to Thought Provoking Talk on Dresser After Dark. Sally Felton with us. She is the author of GPS for Success, Goals and Proven Strategies. She's a radio host. She's a life coach. She's a hypnotherapist, an author, a facilitator, and an inspirational speaker. Her popular radio show, A Fresh Start with Sally Felton, hosts various guests and is designed to provide conscious-raising topics to empower the listeners. Sally's the co-author of several books, including anthology Stepping Stones to Success earlier this year with Deepak Chopra and other luminaries, and now GPS for Success. And let us say, Sally, hi, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much. Nice to be here.
Oh, and thank you so much for being here. You know, when we talk about GPS, we're probably talking about a focus, and there's so many people, their compass is way off, and there's such struggles. They can't seem to put it together between their personal life, their business life, their work, their pleasure, their whatever, and they're running around in a hurry to go nowhere. And I think if you look at 90% of the population out there, to some degree, I think we just described it.
You got it. You hit the nail right on the head. It's exactly the way it is. Everyone's trying to find the holy grail called life balance. How do you do it? What do you need to have in order to make that happen?
Now, by the way, it's an interesting word, the word balance. There's so many people thinking 20 minutes ahead, an hour and a half behind, and it's very hard to get centered into the right now. And that's not sitting on a hill and meditating for 4 hours, 2 feet off the ground. That's not where I'm at with that. But most people, they just can't or won't take the time to just settle down and take a look at what their life is and define it and stop blaming people for whatever is going on.
Well, it's just so much easier to blame. But it takes a lot more courage and determination and focus to say, what's my priority? What do I want here? What's getting in the way? And that's exactly what we do with the exercise in the book. We look at the 12 categories of your life and say, okay, if I'm rating these, 0 to 5, 0 being the very best, and 10, I mean the worst, and 10 being the very best, what's on my personal side of this tree, so to speak, the tree of growth? What's on the right-hand side, my work life? What does that look like? How much time am I putting into each one of these branches? And we really clarify what it is that's out of balance.
You know what I think's out of balance? And if we really take a look at the population, the culture in general, what's out of balance is a person's definition of self.
Yeah.
Self is not what you think I should, you in the general sense of the word, that
yeah.
you think I should be and how I'm supposed to act. And if I don't have a grip on self, I'm in trouble because at my best, Sally, I can only be the second best you. I will never live up to perfection to be the first best you. I'm doomed before I even get off the ground.
Exactly. Yeah, you are. Exactly. Well said, well put.
Okay, now, what's my first step? I'm out of balance here. Homeostasis has gone out the window. What
okay.
do I do to get myself on the road?
You got to figure out what parts of your life, what is your life? What is your personal life? Does your personal life have the categories of your home, your health, your intimacy? And I'm not meaning sex here. I am meaning closeness, support. That's what I'm meaning when I say that. What's your spiritual life like? What is your physical being like? Do you have play or fun in your life? And if you were to rate each one of those, as I said, zero being there's none, I don't have it in my life, or 9 to 10, I've got all of that in my life, take each one of those and dissect it. For example, if you want more of a spiritual life, where do you want that to be? Is it too much, too little? And if you want more balance, do you have to increase it or decrease it? The same for your personal professional job. What's your learning growth like at the what's your office like? What are your finances like? What's your social support like? What are your colleagues like? What's your salary? I mean, what's your family come in your personal life? What is that? And if we look at the whole tree and see, wow, I'm spending way too much or way too little time here, what do I need to cut back on? Somebody could be a workaholic and not spend any time with the family, and yet that's exactly what the family's wanting, and that's what you're wanting. So what do you need to do to back off from some of your work commitments? For example, do you need to answer all your text messages from 7 until 10 at night? What do you need to do to corral that so you're not working 24/7?
You know, one of the most important things I think we could look at also is life, like anything else, it's a process. It's step
it
one,
is.
Two, three, four, five. Yeah, and most of the time we need people, and I say we, everybody falls into this category. Nobody's an expert in everything. You need somebody to look over your shoulder, look at your life through different eyes, and point out the things that you're not seeing. And
yeah.
bring those invisible things up to the table. Because I really believe what I'm hearing you say is if I laid all these questions out in front of me, my goodness, all of a sudden I would see what my life is as opposed to what I was denying it to be.
Mm-hmm. Exactly, exactly. And if you were to do this, and even if you were to ask a spouse, partner, friend, or whatever to take a look at what you are trying to create, and just say with some fresh eyes, what am I missing? And don't take it as a criticism. Take it as another set of eyes looking at it. What am I missing? What am I not seeing here? that I could improve on. It's a great exercise.
And I think one of the problems that most people have, Sally, is they work on a problem that they don't have instead of the one that they do have, and they truly never get anywhere. And I think most importantly, if people did sit down and take a look at it, talk to other people, you're going to be seen differently through lots and lots of different eyes. The only thing that you have to be careful of is make sure that the eyes that are looking at you have got themselves cleaned up first, because if they don't, all they're going to do is project.
Yeah, that's exactly what they're going to do.
Yeah.
Yep. Exactly. Yeah.
So there's a difference between all of it. Now, one of the very important things that I know you talk about is how critical it is to be able to say no. Too many people are frightened to death of that word, because if I say no, then all of a sudden they're not going to like me anymore, and I'm going to I'm going to be without friends. No is critical. No is one of the most precious gifts that a lot of people can have. They just don't realize it.
Exactly. I had my master's and PhD in never saying no. I did it for everybody. And who lost out? Me. I totally lost out. I was exhausted, absolutely exhausted. And the first time I finally said, I would really love to help you, but my plate is full. It was so empowering and so freeing to, one, know that, you know what? There's somebody else that can do the job besides me. I'm not the only one that can do it. And good for me for saying that I couldn't do it and put some boundaries and limitations on what I wanted to do and what I didn't want to do. And it also freed up others to know that, don't ask Sally, she's got her plate full right now. And that was okay. They learned to look outside of always asking me.
You know, most importantly, you use the word shift. Most people really have no idea what the definition of a shift is. You know, we stay on purpose. If your purpose is to sabotage yourself, you stay on purpose. You pull the people in to help you do that so you can prove yourself right about yourself.
Yeah.
Very simple. But the other side of that is just a very simple shift in thinking also shifts the purpose. And instead of the purpose being to sabotage yourself, the purpose is to be more of yourself. And a shift is just as simple as looking at something differently and getting that aha moment, that just quick moment that goes, oh, I don't have to think that anymore.
I don't have to think that I need to do this for everybody else. And what an aha moment to think, wow, that was pretty empowering saying no. And it's even better that I get to choose the things I want to say yes to. That's quite a thought for some people, that they actually get to choose.
That's an interesting word, because most people don't think that they have choice, and you have choice. The key is, there's that old thing about, you know, better unhappy than unsure. People are frightened to death to step outside of themselves. And it's really okay to do that, because the worst thing that's going to happen is you get to take another look at yourself, and then life goes on and stronger. I really believe in my heart of hearts that life is nothing more than one lesson after another, after another, after another. You go through the challenge, you get smacked in the nose, you fall down. If you stay down and afraid to get up, you're going to get hit again until the time comes when you get up. But if when you do get up and you move through the challenge and you become quote unquote balanced, then, you know, the prize at the end of the rainbow is you get to get another challenge, but you're stronger this time and you get to learn something more. Life is nothing more than one lesson after another, which is great.
Perfect. Yeah. And I like the word you used, learning versus mistake.
Yeah.
Some people will say, oh gosh, I really made the mistake. You didn't make a mistake. You learned. You learned from doing. It is a learning moment. We all learn. That's how we evolve.
Everything in and of itself is a gift, a blessing, whatever you want to call it. Because if you go through it, if you've got what it takes to go through, then there's a lot of prizes at the end of the rainbow. A broken up relationship, the loss of a job, a debilitating disease, whatever the case may be. If you move through look at the strength that you get and the quote-unquote the gift that you get out of it. I've seen people time after time. I think the most horrendous thing that can happen to someone if they lose a child. And there was a woman that I know lost a child. And it was horrible. And at the same time, what she decided to do after she'd gone through the grief and the rest of it and the depression was to write a book about it. And then she went out in the talk circuit. And she helped more and more and more people. Well, the child can never be replaced. But what she ended up was I'll call you 4 o'clock in the morning when I remember the word I want. She had that legacy. That's the word I want. She had the legacy that she would have never had, and that child's death caused a lot of people not to die and to live and to be able to rectify things. So in the end result, no matter how horrible it seems at the time, we don't want anybody to go through it. If you go through it and you use it in the proper way, there's nothing but benefit out of it.
Couldn't agree more. It's true. And I see it every day.
Yeah, no question about it. Now, your radio show, which I think is great when you're a talk show host, what do you get to learn about yourself on the show?
What do I get to learn about myself?
Yeah.
I get to learn about my struggles with certain topics.
Yeah.
I get to learn how I intuitively connect with certain guests. It just happens.
Yeah.
I get to learn that I don't self-doubt myself the way I used to. I get to learn that getting out of my comfort zone brings me an awful lot of pleasure. I get to challenge myself. And I get to smile a lot.
Oh, yeah. People should see what goes on behind a microphone.
Yeah, exactly.
It is one of the greatest gifts that anybody can have, because with all of the people, I think life is nothing more than a big mirror. No matter who comes on, whatever the case may be, you got to see yourself in it one way, shape, or form, or you wouldn't have it in front of you.
Mm-hmm.
And what an absolute learning experience that it is. I've been doing this for many, many, many years. And the interviews, you know, there's 5-6 interviews that have been going on for almost 3 decades now.
Mm-hmm.
And you can't even put a dollar value on it what you get on this side of the mic. And every time you hear something, you get to learn more about yourself. You get to sit back and say, oh, I didn't realize that. And the growth is unbelievable. So when somebody does a talk show, if you really get into it, if you really get to the essence and the core of what goes on in the show, my goodness, it just flows and everybody gets something out of it.
It does. And what about when the technological piece of it falls away? If you have a dropped call, if your producer hits the wrong button, you really get to see yourself and how you move towards, I'm going to make this better. I'm going to follow suit here. I'm not going to drop. It's going to be fine. And you just muddle through. And I use humor a lot.
Oh, sure.
A lot.
By the way,
we're
starting to run out of time, but I'm going to tell you my absolute best talk show story. This happened probably close to 30 years ago. I was at KFIR Radio, Fairbanks, Alaska. Those days, we didn't have the faders up and down. You had the knobs and the ads and everything else went on 8-track. You know, this is the good stuff. But we had the 8-second delay. And I'm on about 1 o'clock in the morning. I'm all by myself, you know. And Saturday night was my date with everybody in the city.
Yeah.
And I said to the audience, I said, I'm going to get a little risque, but the end of the story is great. I said to the audience, if you had 3 wishes, what would they be? And this idiot got on the phone and he said, I want to go right to the last wish. I want to be a Tampax. And I hit the button and I said, okay, I got you. Fast fingers dresser. Nobody is going to hear you. And I went on with the show and the break happened and somebody called in and they said, Michael, I said, what? Listen to the radio. And I turned the radio on, and for 15 minutes, the delay looped, And all you heard was, I want to be a Tampax. I want to be a Tampax. Radio, do not we love it?
It's great. It's great. But that's what makes radio radio.
Oh, I know, I know. We're out of time. I could talk to you all night. Let me ask you this. Do you have a website we can find you at?
Yes, www.sallie, S-A-L-L-I-E, Felton, F as in Frank, E-L-T-O-N, lifecoach.com.
Oh, by the way, what area are you in?
I am north of Boston.
Ah, where did you get certified as a hypnotherapist?
By Ted Benton in Winchester Hospital.
Ah, okay. All right. Yeah, I've known a few just out of curiosity. Hey, listen, I want to thank you so much. By the way, we can get the book on the website?
Yes, you certainly can.
Wonderful. Yep. Okay, take care and thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you. Best to you all. Bye-bye.
Good night.
Some of these days, you'll feel so lonely. You're gonna miss my hugging, you miss my kissing, you may even miss me, baby, when I'm gone away. You're gonna feel lonely and want me only, 'cause you know, honey, you're got your way. Say, baby, if you really want me, you know, yeah, you know it's gonna grieve me. You're gonna miss your bony little daddy. Comes a one of these, yeah. Said some of these days I do it so quick, you're gonna miss me, honey. And I'm talking about days gonna miss my hugging, you're gonna miss my kissing, you may even miss me, baby, when I'm long gone away. I hope you feel lonely and want me only, 'cause you know, lover, you're for you.
Welcome back. I'm Michael Bray. You are listening to thought-provoking talk on Dresser After Dark. Jared Dillian with us. He's the author of Street Freak, Money and Madness at Lehman Brothers. It hits it where most people will never even realize that it even exists. He was an integral part of the firm in its final years, but the exhilarating, the explosively stressful job took its toll on Dillian. And the extreme highs, the lows of the trading floor masked and exacerbated the symptoms of his undiagnosed bipolar and obsessive compulsive disorders, leading to a downward spiral that landed him in a psychiatric ward, put his life back together, and got back to work healthier than ever. And let us say, Jared, hi, welcome to the show.
Hey, how's it going?
Oh, good. Hey, by the way, that must have been one ride. I can imagine that should have been a movie.
Well, wouldn't we all like that? It was it was pretty exhilarating. I try to explain to people what it was like, because people will ask me, you know, was that job stressful? And I say, imagine what it's like, you know, if you are a librarian or a teacher or a bus driver, but picture a job where you get so angry maybe once, twice, or three times a day that you really want to commit homicide. You get that angry, and your heart pounds, and you sweat, and that's how intense it is. And that's really what that job is like.
Now, by the way, in that time of your life, would you have really asked for anything else?
No, it was exactly what I wanted. It was exactly what I wanted. I'd wanted to be a trader for a long time. I directed all my activities towards becoming a trader. I studied all the option mathematics, and I went to business school, and, you know, that was my goal in life.
And did you, probably like me, did you watch Wall Street 1 and 2 5 or 6 times?
Well,
The Michael
Douglas.
Wall
Street's Douglas a pretty thing. Good
movie. Yeah.
You know, Wall Street's a pretty good movie. It's, you know, Wall Street is more about, you know, the M&A side and banking than it really is about the secondary markets where I wanted to operate. You know, my first ambition was actually to be a floor trader, like you see at the Chicago Mercantile Exchange or the CBOE or the NYMEX or something like that. That was my first ambition.
Now, by the way, when you were involved in it, was there a thought in your head that there could ever be anything else out there for you, as fast-paced as it was, as wild as it was, as crazy as it was? There had to be something in your blood and the people around you to keep you there.
Well, you know, I never really considered another occupation. The interesting thing is that, you know, there's really, like, I don't come from a Wall Street family. I grew up in Connecticut, but on the other side of Connecticut, you know, eastern Connecticut, kind of towards Rhode Island, it's a little swampy and it's a little backwards, and you don't get too many people that have careers on Wall Street from that part of the state. And, you know, there really wasn't anything in my DNA that said that I wanted to do that. I set foot on a trading floor. It was at the time, it was called the Coffee, Sugar, Cotton, and Cocoa Exchange, and this was in 1998. And I was in love with it. You know, I was absolutely in love with it.
Let me ask you this. When it got over with, you spent some time, you got well, and then you created that daily financial market report, the Daily Dirt Nap. The report in and of itself, do you see it changing drastically based on what goes on politically? You know, you watch a Fox News, a CNN, and the battle goes on, and you hear something that the government did and whatever, and the stocks go down, the stocks go up. Is that enough to drive you crazy?
Well, you know, it's actually a little sad. You know, I mean, if you go back 10, 11, 12 years ago, you could have a financial opinion without having a political opinion. You could value a stock, you could value a bond, you could value a security based on fundamentals and not really like what was going on with the government. And nowadays, you know, the government has such a broad influence over the capital markets. Really, there are, you know, I hate to say it, but there's politics associated with, you know, the trading environment. I mean, if you want to be long stocks, you're making a political statement. If you want to be short stocks, you're making a political statement. If you want to be long gold, you are really making a political statement. So it didn't used to be like that, and it's kind of too bad. But, you know, this is the type of thing that I advise people with.
By the way, do you see our way out of this?
When you say this, do you mean...
Well, this culture that the financial industry has now.
Well, I mean, you know, we are at 3 years after, I mean, today Lehman went bankrupt 3 years ago, and 3 years later we have, you know, a pretty crappy economy. It's, you know, we have unemployment at 9.1%. That's probably going to go higher. There's just, you know, I mean, you know, 10-year yields are below 2%. There's just a lot of signs that things aren't going really well. And, you know, one of the things that I've been writing about a lot recently is, you know, we kind of have a tendency to want to intervene and to do things to fix the situation. You know, we want to fix unemployment. We want to fix the stock market. We want to interfere with a lot of stuff. And, you know, it's really been years and years and years since people have really understood what the true definition of laissez-faire is, to really do nothing. Even the Republicans want to do stuff. The Republicans want to lower taxes, and lower
Sure.
taxes is interfering. I mean, if you really want to get out of this crisis, what we have to do is to do nothing for a long period of time and let the economy heal itself, and it will. But the more we mess with it, the longer it's going to take to heal.
See, and Jared, I think that's where the problem is. And when I say the problem, take somebody like yourself. You've been involved in it. You've had your hands in it. You quote unquote bathed in it, and you've gotten dirty in it. And if somebody wants to know what it's like, they come to somebody like you who's been there and done that. They don't have people like you in government right now, and they should. That's where the key is. You want an answer for something. You want an answer for something. You go to somebody who has some wisdom in it, not academic knowledge, wisdom in it. They've been there. They've fallen down. They've gotten back up, and they see how the trends, the market trends work and what to do with those trends. I think what you're saying is absolutely brilliant. I haven't heard anybody say that, and that's truly what it is. We're cyclical, and if we leave it alone, it'll fix itself.
Yeah, it will take a long time. I mean, a real long time. It'll take 5, 7, 10 years. But, you know, with the Fed, I mean, the Fed is talking about twisting the yield curve, torquing the yield curve, doing QE3, doing unemployment targeting. We're just talking about more and more ways to mess with stuff. And, you know, there's the law of unintended consequences takes hold. We could end up with some really unpleasant inflation. We could end up with some really unpleasant externalities if we keep doing this.
Now, by the way, and when we say we keep doing this, it seems to me, and it's very interesting, you know, I've been around this industry for quite a number of years, and what I've seen is administrations come and go, presidents come and go, but the one thing that has stayed constant through this entire thing that I've been aware of is business. Business stays on course. What their focus is to make money. And I really believe in that old adage, if you want to find out what's going on, where the problems are, follow the money, and it's going to tell you exactly what's going on.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, the interesting thing about business today is that, and this is what really gets people upset, you know, corporate profit margins and corporate profits in general are higher than they've ever been. And so people say, well, you know, if corporate profits are so high, then why don't they just, you know, start hiring people? I mean, unemployment is very high. We have a bunch of people sitting around not working. Why don't corporations start hiring people? And, you know, my answer to that is, well, you know, hire them to do what?
Yeah.
I mean, the economy is contracting. There isn't anything for them to do. We have excess capacity that we need to work off. And so, you know, the funny thing is that we had very low unemployment for a long, long time. They called it the Great Moderation, unemployment of 4, 5, 6%. And when you think about unemployment of 4, 5, or 6%, that's 95% of people who want a job can get a job. And that's pretty remarkable. If 95% of people who want a job can actually get jobs. Now we have 91% of people who want jobs can get jobs. That still doesn't seem awful if you think about it that way.
No. If you look at the reverse side of it, and also we have let most everything go. There's no manufacturing here. There's nothing American made anymore. Each time that there's a major company that starts to make money, we tax it. The company doesn't want to get taxed, and a couple of things happen. Besides it costing their profit, it's also costing them their competitiveness, because now they're going to have to raise their price because they don't have enough money to work with, and it goes off to China, goes off to India, goes off to somewhere else. So realistically, yeah, it's a catch-22 out there.
Yeah. I mean, you know, not to get too political. I'm not a political guy, and I don't like to take sides. But, you know, what the U.S. does in terms of taxation, you talked about taxing. What the U.S. does in terms of taxation is really weird. I mean, we're the only like G20 country that taxes global profits. So if we have a corporation, you know, that earns money overseas in the U.K. or China or Japan or something like that, we tax those profits globally when companies bring the money, repatriate it back to the United States. We're the only country that does that. And so that income is actually taxed twice, because it's taxed locally in the country which it's earned, and then we tax it again when they bring it home. So in practice, corporations don't bring the money home. They leave it abroad.
Yeah, and quote unquote, based on that, Jared, they should.
Based on that. I mean, so, you know, one of the things, if you really want to talk about, you know, the ability to create jobs, I mean, I can't fact check myself on the fly, but I think the number is, you know, $1.2 trillion of you know, corporate money that's sitting overseas. I mean, that's, you know, that would have a real impact if they were able to bring that home on a tax-preferred basis.
Jared, if they would just start drilling here, we would have a lot of money. And that one I'll never understand for as long as I live, because you've got it untapped in Alaska. You got it untapped in Texas. You've got right towards the Canadian border, there's 3, 4, 5 states that is just waiting there to tap into, and we wouldn't have to pay as much money as we pay. You know, when you get it right there at the wellhead, as opposed to the cost per barrel there, and then you've got the shipping, and then you've got the real retail cost added to that. And by the time, you know, it comes to you and I, that's a lot of money. And a lot of it was forecasted in futures anyway. So this stuff is crazy. If we did it right here, we would be fine. There would be people. It wouldn't solve all the problems, but we would have jobs. We'd have a couple bucks to spend, and it wouldn't be insane, and people could be driving back and forth. This stuff is killing people even to go to work.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know. You seem to know more about the energy markets than I do. But, you know, the one thing I will say is that, You know, you can make the argument, and, you know, my father has, actually. He's really into this stuff. I mean, you can make the argument that the reason that the U.S. economy performed so well for the last century was because we had cheap and abundant energy available to us at all times.
Yeah.
You know? So.
By the way, when you see your dad, tell him I like him. We think of him. But that's realistically what it is. Okay, let me ask you this. The book in and of itself, the Street Freak, what was the core message? What is it that, let's say, Jared, I pick the book up, I read it page by page, cover to cover. What is it that I, Michael Ray, will get out of that book by the time I'm done?
Okay. Let me just say that, you know, I mean, I'm a financial guy, and I have a financial newsletter, and I express financial opinions. But this book, it's not a book with a point, okay? It's just to be enjoyed. It's a story, okay? It's just my story, and it is a great story. Now, there are two things you can take away from it. One, for anybody who's interested in what it's like to be on a trading floor at a major Wall Street firm, especially for people who are thinking about getting a job there, you know, undergraduates and business school students, the book is a must-read. You have to read it. It is the best description of a trading floor ever in print. I guarantee it. The second part of the book is that, I struggled with mental illness while I was there. You know, I have bipolar disorder. In the old days, they used to call that manic depressive illness. And that means that you go through periods of mania followed by periods of depression. And, you know, I had it for a long time, and I worked there, and my behavior was pretty bizarre. And it went unnoticed because generally on a trading floor, you have periods of mania followed by periods of depression. And, you know, my behavior just went unnoticed.
No, by the way, the trading floor in and of itself, could that, excuse me for saying it this way, but that, could that take somebody that did not have the bipolar problem and drive them, you know, beyond the breaking point?
Well, I a lot of people have asked me that, you know, whether the job exacerbated the symptoms. And I don't really know the answer to that. I mean, you know, bipolar disorder or manic depressive illness is something you inherit. It's not something that you, it's not contagious. You know, you don't just get it. It's something you get from your parents, and it develops around age 18. So I had had it for a long time. Did the work environment exacerbate it? I tend to think that it did because, you know, my symptoms got, you know, more and more acute the longer I worked at that job.
Okay, now the job in and of itself, obviously, was probably one of the best things that ever happened to you because if you'd have been in another job, it probably wouldn't have triggered everything that would cause you to go get healthy, and it could have been underlying for you, and you wouldn't be doing what you're doing now, and you wouldn't be writing a book, and you wouldn't have the paper.
Well, I mean, if you want to look at it from an existential sense, then, I mean, yeah, yeah. Like, you know, where I am today is absolutely where I need to be. So I totally agree with that statement.
No, I got it, Jerry. Now, by the way, where do we find the paper? Where do we get? Can we sign up for it? How does that work?
The daily newsletter? Dirt Nap. Well, the newsletter is called the Daily Dirt Nap, and you can go to my website. It's called www.dailydirtnap.com. And there's a big description of what the Daily Dirt Nap is about. It's a little bit expensive. It costs $600 per person per year. It comes out once a day. It's 3 pages, so it's pretty meaty. You know, I publish a lot. I write a lot. And it basically looks at the financial markets I hate to sound kind of navel-gazing, but, you know, I don't really talk about news. I talk about philosophy. I talk about trading philosophy. I talk about how to be a better trader. And that sounds like, you know, kind of a squishy thing to write about, but my clients are, you know, very happy with the newsletter and what it does for them.
Now, by the way, I'm hearing it in a completely different way. This, you know, your target market is going to be for those people who are in, they're trading, they're doing it, they're either making or losing money, and if you've got that information behind you to be able to think out, you know, making a buy and the philosophy behind the buy beforehand, $600 has got to be making these people money.
Well, you know, I mean, my turnover is pretty low. I probably lose, you know, 15% of my subscribers every year, which is, you know, pretty reasonable. I think if people weren't making money off of it, they would unsubscribe because it is a little bit expensive. It's you know, $600 is a lot to spend on something if you're not going to get anything out of it. So I do think people get something out of it.
I hear you loud and clear. We're just about out of time. Again, the website we can find you at, Jared.
The website is www.dailydirtnap.com. That's the Daily Dirt Nap. But more important, the book is out. It's called Street Freak, Money and Madness at Lehman Brothers, and it can be found wherever books are sold.
Wonderful. Hey, Jared, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks a lot.
Take care. Good night.
That's all.
Night.
Only give you country walks in springtime, and a hand to hold when leaves begin to fall, and a lover's burning light will warm the winter night. That's all. That's all. There are those, I am sure, who have told you they would give you the world for a toy. All I have are these arms to enfold you, and a love time can never. If you're wondering what I'm asking in return, dear, you'll be glad to know that my demands are small. Say it's me that you'll adore, for now and evermore. That's all. That's all. You'll be glad to know that my demands are small. Say it's me that you adore. Yeah, it's me that you adore. For now and evermore. That's all.
A dream lover will come my way. A girl to hold in my arms and know the magic of her charms. Because I want a girl to call my own. I want a dream lover so I don't have to dream alone. So true, and a hand that I can hold to feel you near as I grow old. Because I want a girl to call my own. I want a dream lover so I don't have to dream alone.
Welcome back. I'm Michael Ray. You're listening to Thought Provoking Talk on Dresser After Dark.
I don't know how.
David Ant's with us. He's a nationally acclaimed safety expert with over 14 years' experience in the personal and professional safety field. He's developed the Saber Law Enforcement Training Division, which works with thousands of police departments around the world. He's also been a featured guest on the History Channel's Modern Marvel series and Spike TV's Don't Be a Victim. He was a guest on the National Rifle Association self-defense video series and PoliceOne.com and so much more. David, I welcome to the show.
Thank you, Michael Ray. How are you this evening, sir?
Oh, I'm good, and thank you so much for being here. You know, David, I would think that, 15, 20 years ago, you had to learn how to protect yourself. There's no question about it. But in today's world, I have no idea why it got so violent that I think what you're offering is, you know, it's life-saving.
Absolutely. That's what we're focusing on. We're focusing on keeping college students safe, keeping individuals safe, getting people to take responsibility for their personal safety. There's a number of things that we teach in and of themselves that will go a long way to preventing these attacks from occurring. Basically, we want to instill confidence and empower individuals and particularly college students with our Saber College Safety Program.
You know, by the way, just from your press release, some of the interesting stats that in the next hour, the following will happen across the United States. 900 thefts, 189 violent crimes, 124 assaults, 66 robberies, 24 sexual assaults, 12 rapes, and 2 murders. Unbelievable.
These things are happening every day, and I think that what the challenge is getting individuals to realize that these things are actually occurring. I mean, we do have over 2 million inmates in our correctional facilities throughout the United States because these crimes are occurring. And we can prevent them from occurring. We can go a long way towards preventing them, and we can teach people ways and techniques to do that. But the first thing you have to realize is that this is an issue. These things are happening out there, and you need to have a plan. You need to take it. You need to take responsibility for your personal safety, and that's what our classes provide.
Now, by the way, when we talk about personal safety, you know, you get somebody, you get a woman who's 5 foot tall, 90 to 100 pounds, and you get two guys out there who are 6 foot three and they're monstrous. Is there any help for them?
Absolutely. You know, it's interesting. The first we teach our students to think, to have the mindset, understand the mindset of an attacker. There's a targeting phase. There's a testing phase. Basically what they do is they're looking for someone who's vulnerable, who's not paying attention to their surroundings, someone who's a soft target, someone that's going to be easy to take advantage of. So what we teach our students, regardless of your size, regardless of your fighting skills or your strength, you want to walk around confident, empowered, aware of your surroundings. And that will go a long way towards discouraging a threat, regardless of that individual's size, because they're looking for someone who looks vulnerable, who looks like they're not aware of what's happening around them, who looks like they might be scared. You know, it's kind of like if you think about a game of tag. If you're the person who's trying to catch the other people, you're going to go after the person that's slower, that's an easier target. And that's exactly what they're looking for. So we teach, regardless of your size or strength, the ability to be confident so you can discourage threats.
You know, by the way, somebody once said to me a long time ago, David, and I've stayed with this, when you're out in public, you know, and if you're by yourself, walk with an attitude.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
In fact, that's one of the things that we teach in our Sabre College Safety Program that gets a lot of, it provides a form of entertainment, but it's also a very easy way for our students to remember. We teach them to walk like a supermodel would. And if you think about a supermodel when they're walking up and down a runway, they're walking with their head up, they're scanning the room, shoulder back, and they look very confident. And if you think about it, most supermodels will intimidate men. If you walk like a supermodel, you're going to be aware of your surroundings. You're going to have presence, and that presence is probably going to intimidate someone. It's going to discourage them, and they're going to think, you know what, I'm probably better off taking my time and effort towards someone else who's an easier target.
You know, my sister has a girlfriend, and she just told me a story today where the girlfriend was in her car. It was fairly late, and there was this woman sitting in a van parked by the street, and she waved her down, and my sister's girlfriend stopped, and she actually got out of her car, walked over to the van, and she said, and the woman is saying, I ran out of money, and I don't know where this is, and she says, can you come a little closer to the van? Well, she finally decided that this was not the best thing in the world to do. She got back in her car and got out of there. But it could have been seconds later, and she would have been gone. There are people out there that will hurt you, and most people, they don't go beyond what they would do. I wouldn't hurt anybody, and at the same time, that doesn't mean that somebody's out there that wouldn't hurt me.
Well, you're exactly right, and you need to be very careful when you're in public. You know, a safe place to be when you're in public is 12 feet away from a stranger. That gives you an opportunity to react, because if they're going to attack you, you don't know that. That's a big advantage they have over you, is they know when that attack's going to occur. They decide. You don't know, so you're going to have to be reactive. And action is always quicker than reaction. So you need to have some distance between you and that individual, regardless if they're asking you what time it is, they seem like they're nice, they're asking for directions. If you feel okay and you want to give them the information, make sure you do it at a distance. Be very skeptical. Do not approach someone in a car, a van, or, you know, in situations where you could increase your vulnerability. Keep them at a safe distance.
I think it was in the early 90s. I was up in Alaska in those days. And in the early 90s, they allowed the concealed carry permit, which I got one at the time. And then I guess it was at the late 90s, the governor, the new governor said, throw them away, just carry, you don't need any kind of a permit. But one of the things that they taught us, which I will never forget way back when, was if you're in an alley, quote unquote, and you're being approached by a couple of guys, and you're carrying, and you don't know if they are or not, he said, run, and which I think was the greatest advice in the world. Just because you have a gun doesn't mean that you, quote-unquote, have to use it. But the thing I like about conceal carry. And I'm in the Milwaukee area, so Wisconsin, I think, October, November is going to finally get a concealed carry permit. And what I think I like about that more than anything else, it's going to make people think twice about stopping somebody because that person may have a gun.
Well, you're right. I mean, I think if you look at crime statistics across the country, areas where individuals are allowed to carry concealed, you see a decrease in robberies. You see a decrease in assaults and things of that nature because people, criminals fear are aware of the fact that people may be carrying concealed. So, the NRA certainly wants you to believe that, and there are statistics that back that up. So, I think there is a lot of truth to that. I think that you raise an important point, though. And what we teach in our programs is twofold. We teach you ways to discourage threats, and you can go a long way towards doing that by incorporating things that we teach in our Saber Personal Safety Academy. You have to have a plan. That's the first part of the plan. But you can do everything right, and the attack may still happen. So you have to have a way to protect yourself, whether it's carrying concealed with lethal force or having a non-lethal way to protect yourself. I'm a big fan of pepper spray, knowing how to use it properly so you can protect yourself at a safe distance. You have to have Plan B, which is the ability to protect yourself, and that's where carrying concealed or carrying pepper spray come into play.
Yeah, I think one of the biggest problems with the law, quote-unquote, today, and by the way, I'm a real strong proponent of the rule of law, and I'm as an American as you could possibly get, former Marine and on, so I'm there with that. But I think one of the biggest problems with the law today as regards to guns, and I'm not going to do the whole show about guns, but the law is, the bad guys are going to get their guns no matter what they do. And the law is for the people who are not going to break the law in the first place. And they leave people very vulnerable. Because if you're in your home and you get people who break in, and I do want to discuss that about burglar-proofing your home, there are people who will break into your house today. They'll break the door down. And if you have nothing to protect yourself, you're in major trouble. So there's some very interesting things going on with the law. And sometimes I wonder who the law is for.
Yeah, I don't disagree with exactly what you're saying. If you could outlaw firearms throughout the United States, and cocaine's illegal, I'm pretty sure people are acquiring that. So it's not there. Sure. Look, any country in the world, people who want to get firearms are able to get firearms. That will always be the case. So you're not going to prevent the bad guys from attaining them, but you will prevent the good guys from being have the ability to protect themselves and their families. So I completely agree with you. But in those areas, I think it's good to have both non-lethal and lethal means to protect yourself. Regardless of which one you're going to choose, or if you're going to choose both, you should certainly take classes and be ready to use those products, both physically, emotionally, mentally. So in a high-stress situation, you'll be effective and you'll be responsible in using those type of products. And that's what we teach in our class. We're big advocates of personal safety sprays. We're big advocates of lethal products as well. But my programs focus on non-lethal. So we actually we teach you how to protect yourself at a safe distance. We put you through scenarios with an attacker, so you're able to use personal safety sprays, pepper sprays, so you can protect yourself at a safe distance. So if you're ever in that situation, you've now done it. You have the confidence and the muscle memory to perform effectively in a high-stress situation.
And by the way, David, question. Now, I see that you're in the Los Angeles area, right?
Actually, no, I'm in Chicago.
Oh, no, I got it backwards. Okay, 310's L.A. Okay, 312 Chicago.
312,
if you yell loud enough, right, we'll probably hear you over here.
Right down the road from you, right?
Okay, well, now you've made my question easy. I was going to say, if you were in Los Angeles, how do you get into your classes? But you guys are in Chicago. You're an hour away from me.
Mm-hmm.
So how
yeah,
do you get
actually, in the Chicagoland area, we have tons of universities, and we offer our Saber Civilian Safety Awareness Program for businesses, community groups. And the neat thing about it is they're being taught by the Chicago PD. One of their officers created the Women's Tactical Association. So they have a group of a couple dozen women here in Chicago. They're actually nationwide now, but started here in Chicago. And they teach our classes, and the female instructors do very, very well with the college students. And then we have a number of male instructors as well that go out and teach the community groups and things of that nature. So right down the road from us, and we actually have instructors in Wisconsin as well. As of right now, we have about 300 instructors operating, teaching in about 35 states.
Okay, so you're teaching the teachers.
Absolutely. I teach the classes as well myself, But, you know, in order to be able to offer my program nationwide, I instruct instructors on how to teach the program. And if you want to find an instructor in your area, you just go to personalsafetyexpert.com, enter in your contact. There's a link to find an instructor. You can enter in your contact details, and it'll provide you with the instructors that are closest to you.
Okay, now on a practical level, let's say that I come in. What am I going to get taught? Hands on now. What's going to happen? What am I going to learn?
Well, for example, the first half of the program is teaching you ways to discourage a threat. And if you're going to the Civilian Safety Awareness Program, we'll give you practical scenarios that you'll face when commuting to and from work, when, you know, walking across parking lots, situations where you're vulnerable, which basically everyone, regardless of how alert and aware you are. Did you mention that you were a Marine?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yes, former, many years ago.
We have incorporated the conditioned yellow technique into our program, which is created by the late Lieutenant Colonel James Cooper, and that's basically a relaxed 360-degree awareness that we teach you, and that's a big, big focus on our program. So, the first half of either our personal safety class or our college safety class is ways to discourage threats, things you can do to be a hard target so they will not attack you in the first place. Then the second portion of the class, we teach you ways to protect yourself at a safe distance, how to properly use and responsibly use personal safety sprays or pepper sprays. We put you through a series of drills so you're able to protect yourself. You have the muscle memory, the confidence, and the know-how. So when you're in that high stress situation, you're very effective. And then lastly, we teach you some simple self-defense techniques. So if someone is up on you quickly, you can use these techniques to escape an attacker.
Now, by the way, when you talk muscle memory, you're talking about automatic response now, right?
Yeah, basically, when you do something over and over again, that's exactly right. You don't have to think about it. It just becomes second nature. So when you're in a high-stress scenario, your body is still able to perform. That's exactly what we're talking about.
Okay, so in essence, when you do it, and you do it, and you do it, it just happens without thinking. And I think that's probably one of the biggest problems people have when they're being, quote-unquote, attacked. They start to think. When they start to think about it, everything slows down and nothing happens, and that's where the real problems start. And I think, you know, in today's world, with all of the violence that's going on, I watch where I go. I won't go into empty parking lots and so on and so forth. I mean, my goodness, why ask for it? And it's a shame that we have to be that way. And it's a shame that there's no consequence for a lot of the bad guys out there. And they're not afraid to do anything that they want to do because they're not afraid of the police anymore. And that in and of itself, I think, is a major problem.
It is. And there's also a lot fewer law enforcement officers on the streets than there were prior to the economic crisis our country is now facing. You know, and I do law enforcement instructing as well. And the academies are not full right now. They're not hiring, and people are retiring, which means agencies are becoming smaller and smaller. The NYPD, for example, the largest municipal police department in the country, sat at 44,000 officers prior to the economic crisis. They are now down to 33,000. They've had a 25% reduction. So there's fewer officers in the street. There's longer response times. So absolutely, the criminals are less affected by them. And, you know, all the more reason why we need to take responsibility for our personal safety.
Okay, now two things. We're starting to run out of time. First is, if I want to become an instructor, who do I contact? What do I do to get the training?
Absolutely. Well, you would go to personalsafetyexpert.com, and you can add your contact information right there on the website, and we'll send out the instructor information to you. That's the best place to start.
Okay, now if I want to be a class participant, same thing?
Same thing. The programs, you can also go to saberred.com/college for the college safety program. But Personal Safety Expert will provide you with all the information you need.
Okay, then we're going to leave, but I'm going to give you a secret. You got to promise not to tell anybody just between us now, okay? You ready for this?
Okay.
But I went through boot camp in June of 1960. But we're not going to tell anybody that.
All right.
It was a couple of years ago. All right, hey, but David Nance, thank you so much for joining us. I appreciate it. And I think we're going to have you back on again. This is so critical today to be able to protect yourself. And this isn't going out and beating people up. This is saying that if your family, you know, your kids, your college kids, the rest of it, they're out in situations that they're going to get home, and they're going to get home safe. And I love everything you're doing. So thank you so much for joining us tonight.
Absolutely, Michael Ray. My pleasure.
Take care. Good night.
Good night.
Hello, young lovers, whoever you are, I hope your troubles are few. All my good wishes go with you tonight. I've been in love like you. You be brave, young lovers, and follow your star. Brave and faithful and true. And cling very close to each other tonight. I've been in love like you. And I know how it feels to have wings on your heels and to fly down the street in a trance. You fly down that street on the chance that you'll meet, and you meet not by chance. Don't cry, young lovers, whatever you do. Say don't cry because I'm alone. All my good wishes go with you tonight. I have had a love of my own. And I know how it feels to have wings on your heels and to fly down the street in a trance. You wing down that street on the chance that you'll meet, and you meet not by chance. Don't cry, young lovers, whatever you do. Say don't cry because I'm alone. All of my memories are happy tonight. I've had a love of my own. Hallelujah! I've had a love of my own like yours. I have had a love of my own.
Welcome back. I'm Michael Ray. You are listening to Thought Provoking Talk on Dresser After Dark. Suzanne Zaccone with us, and she is the author of A Random Interruption, Surviving Breast Cancer with Laughter, Vodka, Smoothies, and an Attitude. And Suzanne, hi, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
By the way, did I pronounce your last name right?
You did. It's Zaccone.
Zaccone. Okay, no, good. I wanted to make sure I got it. You're an entrepreneur and with one of the marquee Who's Who of American women, and you got diagnosed with breast cancer. She found there was a shortage of information available that melded personal experience with medical realities. And I think that's a problem with most women today. They are frightened to death of it. And by the way, breast cancer is not only women. Men get it also. And one of the big problems is we don't know, and we don't know where to go. And it's too bad somebody like yourself has had to go through it to be able to tell us, but thank goodness you're there.
Oh, I'm glad to be there.
Yeah. Now, by the way, how did you deal with it?
Well, when I was diagnosed, I was completely surprised by it, like probably 90% of the people who I speak to when they're giving that diagnosis of having been diagnosed with cancer. I was terrified. I had also been very, very healthy up until that point and was not real familiar with the system of the healthcare system, and I was terrified of doctors. So I went on a tour of the medical community within the Chicagoland area and actually interviewed 5 doctors to make sure not only did I find the right facility that could handle the type of cancer that I had, but also that I found the physician that I knew that I was going to have to spend a great deal of time with.
Now, by the way, when you know, we talk about, you know, laughter and so on and so forth, how did you when you dealt with it, when you got the diagnosis, it had to be scary. I mean, there's no question about that. But when you got the diagnosis, what was your first reaction to it?
My first reaction was, oh, my God, I'm going to die. That was my honest to God first reaction. And I spent the first 6 weeks crying just about every day for a couple hours, going into my office, doing research on the computer, watching surgeries, trying to find the right facility and the right physician, and it was just a mumble jumble. And the biggest concern was, when you're given that diagnosis, what questions do you even ask a physician? So
sure.
When I was out there trying to do my research, I found 2 types of books. One was a really good story about someone who had been diagnosed and they fought it and it was terrible, the end. not a lot of details on what to expect and how to get through it. The other type of book I found were medical tomes, 3 inches long or 3 inches deep, with words so long it would take 3 breaths to get through. So there wasn't really anything in between that melded the complete research for every single problem and opportunity and test and procedure along with the medical reality. So what I started to do was not write a book. What I started to do was to advise my friends and family of what was going on with me without having to answer the phone and go through these questions over and over and over again. And what was happening, because I was detailing every significant test or procedure or experience, I was getting feedback from people who said, my aunt was just diagnosed, or my kid's kindergarten teacher, or my sister, and I think what you wrote last week might help them. Do you mind if I pass it along? Which, of course, I said yes. And then I started to recognize that there might be a larger audience out there because this continued to happen. So I was convinced that maybe a book would be a great idea. I'd always had visions of being an author, like probably a lot of people. And so the book is really 499 pages of every single thing that happened to me, my response, the issues that I found to get through it, some life lessons along the way. The back of the book has questions to ask each doctor in the process, because you see about 5 specialists. And then there's also a small dictionary of the language of breast cancer. Quite often I found myself in the office and being, even with someone with me, listening to the doctor and having these words thrown at me, and I would ask for an explanation and get one. And then what I would have to do is try to remember it or write it down fast enough before he continued on with his conversation. So this is a nice way for someone to make a reference.
No question about it. I think one of the biggest problems that I've seen with allopathic medicine, to give you a personal story, 13 years ago, I had cancer also. Been there, done that. And I remember the first thing that happened when they diagnosed me, the words out of my mouth was, how do you fix it? And I went down and had some surgery. And I saw the doctor that that was in the city that I was in at the time 5-6 years later. And they gave me basically a year and a half to live with chemo and radiation, all that stuff. That was 13 years ago. I'm here. And I had no chemo, no radiation, didn't do any of that. So I saw the doctor, and I'll never forget. We're at the airport, and it was about Christmas time. And I said, hey, whatever his name was. And he said, hey, 5 years later, and I'm still here. You know, it was very interesting. He looked at me like he made a mistake because he said I would be dead, and he almost looked disappointed. You know, there are those things that you have to go through because of somebody making a decision. So finding the right doctor for those kind of things is extremely important.
It really is, Michael. And the other thing that I found was getting a second or a third opinion. Now, I admit that I went overboard with 5, but what I did find in one part of my research was that I kind of had an idea of what I wanted to do, and I saw another doctor, and he told me that I was completely a terrible candidate for that type of procedure. And I asked him why and kind of dug a little deeper. And what I ultimately learned was he wasn't comfortable with the kind of procedure that I really wanted.
Yeah.
So if you go to a doctor and your first question or your second or your third is, what do I do next? And you go to that doctor and then you respond and you go to the next, you're really not giving yourself the full opportunity to find out what is out there medically. What is out there as far as a difference of opinion, and why would there be one? And if there is, explain that to me so I can make an educated response. So, you know, I'm glad that you're still alive after 13 years. I'm glad you didn't have to experience chemo and radiation. They're nasty.
But, by the way, they said to do it, and I said no. I had lung cancer. I mean, they took my right lung. They took
3B.
3B. They took out my right lung, part of the lining of my heart, and it was residual cancer left on my heart, and they said I'd be dead in a year and a half without the chemo and the radiation. That was 13 years ago now. And the point was that I said, no. And they said, who do you want to do the operation? I said, nobody here. And I found them in Seattle where, you know, it was like an assembly line. These guys knew what they were doing. I got in, I got out, and I did my stuff. But the point of contention is that it's called, just like you did, don't listen to everybody. Go find out yourself, because you may be in the wrong place at the wrong time with somebody who, you just said it, that's not comfortable with that particular procedure.
Right. Wow, yeah, no, I'm impressed.
I'm here, you know, contrary to some people who'd rather me not be here, but I'm here. But that's, I think a lot of it also, too, Susanna's attitude.
Mm, most definitely. Again, like I mentioned, my first response was, I think I'm going to die. And then I had 6 weeks of absolute abject terror. And then I decided that I was going to fight this. And that's I think, a response a lot of people go through, maybe for a different period of time, longer, shorter. And then once I started to want to fight for this, everything kind of changed.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, absolute mindset. I was sitting in the garage, and I figured if I had to get an operation, I was going to get in the best physical condition I could be in. And I was running the hills and everything. I was sitting in the garage one day, and I'm on one of those stationary bikes. And I'm pedaling away and sweating. Then it hit me. I made it okay to die. I didn't say I wanted to die. I just said, okay, if that's what's going to happen, that's what's going to happen. Suzanne, the moment I did that, I took the stress off. And when the stress came off, I think the immune system kicked in and started working. But that's really what the key is. It wasn't a resistance. It's okay, let's do something about this. And if that's what's going to happen, that'll happen. But I'm not going down easy.
Exactly. Exactly. Yeah. And that's where the laughter helps, too, you know, where you try to just fend off all that negative stuff is the best way you can. And how I sign my books is, remember that the best time to laugh is any time you can. And that's so true, especially when you're going through cancer or a medical crisis.
But there's an even stronger reason for that. When you laugh, your brain releases endorphins. That's the feel-good stuff. And it changes your entire system. So in essence, laughter is the best medicine, because it's actually a chemical reaction in your brain which causes you to lighten up.
I agree.
Yeah, yeah, no, it's good stuff. That also, you know, that also, and the vodka and the smoothies, and plus the attitude. I mean, that a combination like that you can't beat.
You neither did at different times, and sometimes in different combinations.
Yeah, I hear you loud and clear. What did you get out of this? What was the big lesson in this for you?
I'm not sure if there's one. I think there's many. On a way, way, way through the filter personal kind of level, that I can actually walk into a hospital without breaking into a cold sweat. As I said earlier, I was completely terrified of everything medical. And I think the other thing I got out of it was that there's a big need for me to get out there and tell my story, because it really goes into detail as to what these tests mean and what your options are and what your rights are. And it's funny. It's not a why me kind of a story. It's a funny story. It'll make you laugh, and I've heard it'll make you cry. But what I think I've learned also is that there are not enough experts around the country that can do the kinds of things that I had available in Chicago. I went to the University of Chicago Cancer Research Hospital, and my reconstruction surgeon is world-renowned. His name is Dr. David Song. He and his team do an incredible microsurgery that you wouldn't believe the outcome. And I've spoken to so many women and seen so many women who've had quite the different outcome, and a lot of them are flying into Chicago. And I can't keep them all at my house while they're in recovery. So what we're doing with the profits from the book that I wrote is 100% is going back to the University of Chicago through our foundation. But in order for a doctor to receive one of our fellowships, and that's how the form it takes, they have to agree to be trained under my team, or the team at the University of Chicago, and then go to another hospital in another state in the United States that we've not yet covered. What I'm trying to do is to bring this expertise closer to women, and so they don't have to go coming into Chicago or going into New York or going into South Dakota where I know that these teams are already in place. So that's what I learned. I need to help these other families.
Yeah, but the growth for you, the growth for you, the legacy for you, and if you really think about it, is look at the lives you get to touch that you didn't before. I wonder how many lives that, and you'll never know, through somebody who told somebody who told somebody, a life you've saved.
Exactly. I do get a lot of incredibly great feedback on my website, and I do often keep in touch with these women because the process, as you know, even if you didn't go through chemo and radiation, you knew it was coming at you if you did, it's about a three-year situation. So you get to kind of know these women and sometimes their families, and I kept in touch with them. I probably speak to 7 or 8 new women a month, and that's in addition to the women that I keep in touch with at whatever point they are in their challenge.
Let me tell you, we're just about running out of time. Let me tell you a funny cancer kind of story, okay? After it was all over and done with, you know, and I went in for a checkup for something, and they did an ultrasound on me. So I'm laying there on the table. They do the ultrasound, and the technician looks at me, and she goes outside, and she comes back, and she looks at me, and she goes outside again, and she comes back. Now, I happen to be Jewish, so I know I'm dying, right? Because they're coming in and out. They're having problems. I've got to go talk to the doctor. So finally, I stopped her, and I said, is there a problem here? She said, I had to go get the doctor. I said, why? She said, I can't find your heart. What happened was, because when they took the lung out, everything moved over. And on the ultrasound, I guess my lung was hiding behind her, my heart was hiding behind a rib or something, and it scared her because there was no heart in there.
Oh, my gosh. That would be pretty scary.
For her, I had a heart. It was good. Yeah, I've been accused of not having one before, but not like that. Okay, we're about... Suzanne, is there a website we can find you at?
Yes, www.arandominterruption.com.
Wonderful. And I want to thank you so much for joining us. And you know, stories like yours should be told because you get to touch people beyond and beyond. You know, 300 years from now, there might be somebody running around that'll never know you existed, but if it wasn't for you, they wouldn't be here.
Ooh, that's a nice feeling.
Okay, good night.
Have a great night.
You too.
Bye-bye.
The makeup. Off comes the clown's disguise. The curtains falling. The music softly dies.
I'm Michael Ray Dresser, and that, my friends, is a wrap.
But I hope you're smiling as you're filing out the door, as they say in this bit. That's all there is. There isn't any more. We've shared a